Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on this hour, we'll sit down with Berkeley's new mayor, Adina Ishii, to hear about her plans and priorities as she takes office. And then we'll speak with San Francisco's new poet laureate, Jenny Lim, about her work and what she hopes to achieve in her new role. But first, California lawmakers and Governor Gavin Newsom passed hundreds of laws in 2024, and many of these went into effect on January 1st. From cracking down on retail theft to changes in housing, online activities, and renters' rights, they all aim to address a wide array of challenges. Here tonight to give us an overview of the new laws and what they might mean for us, I'm pleased to be joined by Sophia Bolag, who is a politics reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Sophia.
Thanks for having me back on.
So, Sophia, let's start with retail theft. Now, many of our Bay Area cities, but in particular San Francisco, have been struggling since the pandemic with retail theft, in part due to emptier streets with increased remote work. And there is this perception now that crime is out of hand. So a number of these new laws passed by the legislature seem to be aimed at cracking down on this type of crime and as a way to bring life back to our cities. Can you just give us some of the highlights of that group of new laws?
Yeah, so the laws you're referencing, there's about 11 that lawmakers passed that aim to crack down on retail theft and other types of crimes. And they do an array of different things, but broadly speaking, they aim to make it easier to prosecute people who steal repeatedly or people who are part of like organized retail theft rings. Lawmakers who passed this legislation say that's really who they want to target in an effort to sort of crack down on this problem of retail theft. It's worth noting these new laws will come sort of on top of Prop 36, which your listeners may remember. If they're California residents, they probably voted on it back in November. That measure passed, and it also aims to sort of crack down on retail theft as well as drug crimes by essentially making repeat theft and drug crimes that were previously misdemeanors in California law into felonies. So there's an overall crackdown on theft crimes that's going to be happening with both those new laws from the legislature and the proposition enacted by voters.
And Sophia, were any of these laws particularly, you know, more controversial than others, or did they get pretty widespread support in the legislature?
I would say they got fairly widespread support. They were negotiated. They were actually initially really part of an effort to provide an alternative to Prop 36 by lawmakers. The California legislature, as your listeners might be aware, is heavily dominated by Democrats. They have super majorities in both chambers. And so they tend to have pretty liberal policy views. And a lot of them had concerns about Prop 36, that it would sort of over-penalize people who were accused of stealing or relatively low-level drug possession type crimes. And so, you know, this retail theft package was really billed as an alternative to Prop 36. And what ended up happening is lawmakers passed the bills, Newsom signed them into law, and then voters also chose to enact Prop 36. So, that's essentially how it happened.
So they didn't have the benefit of knowing if it was going to pass. So lots coming down the pike then, and already here in terms of retail theft prosecutions and enforcement. Just staying on this theme of revitalizing our downtowns in California, can you describe the new laws authorizing cannabis cafes and downtown entertainment zones? What's on tap there?
Yeah, so the new cannabis cafe law was really in response to, recreational marijuana use was legalized in California, there was this idea that it would result in this big economic boon for these legal cannabis businesses, and a lot of them have really struggled. And so this is one way to try to bolster that newly legal industry it basically allows cannabis retailers to sort of act as a cafe and make and sell food and non-alcoholic beverages that they can serve on their premises. Previously, they were only able to sell prepackaged food. So really trying to make them sort of more of a space to hang out in the jurisdictions that want to allow those. Entertainment zones, that new law will essentially allow local governments in California to let bars and restaurants sell alcohol for people to consume in public, and just sort of allow for more drinking on public streets and sidewalks mm-hmm. in these zones that local governments choose to enact within their boundaries.
All right, so we may be becoming a bit more like Amsterdam, maybe some more good times on tap for some residents at least. I want to move to the theme of consumer protections and help for consumers in general. I understand California lawmakers were focused on this issue, and one law that maybe many Californians or some of our listeners might be excited about is the Click to Cancel law. Can you give us an overview of that law?
Yeah, this law basically aims to make it easier for people to cancel subscriptions, particularly ones that are automatically renewing. So basically, it requires companies that offer subscriptions to let their customers cancel their subscriptions in the same way that they sign up for them. So if you clicked a button to sign up for a subscription, under this law, you should be able to click a button to, sign off of the subscription and end it. It aims to really prevent companies from making it really easy to sign up and then really hard to cancel their subscriptions when they decide they don't want a service anymore.
And we're speaking with Sophia Bolag, who is a politics reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, about new laws that are now in effect as of January 1st in California. Sophia, I also wanted to ask you about another law that's targeting bank fees. Can you talk about that and when it would apply?
Yeah, so that law took effect January 1st at the start of the year, and it prohibits state chartered banks from fining customers when they try to withdraw money that have insufficient funds in their accounts.
All right, and then there's also new law that maybe didn't get a lot of attention on medical debt. Legislators passed a bill that would hopefully prevent medical debt from ruining Californians' credit. Can you just share any details of that law?
Yeah, basically this law aims to avoid penalizing people who are accessing healthcare services that they need. And it prohibits credit bureaus from including medical debt on people's credit reports. So the idea is that, accessing healthcare, not being able to afford it, doesn't, impact your credit score in the same way that like not paying off a credit card bill, for example, would.
And this is an issue that we covered on this show previously. Was about AI deep fakes, which are essentially sexually explicit deep fakes. Should we know anything about this new law with AI related protections that the governor just signed?
Yeah, this is one of a number of laws that the governor signed related to AI. He signed a number of incremental steps to regulate this emerging type of technology. And the one I believe you're referring to basically makes it illegal to create and then disseminate sexually explicit images of real people that are intended to cause serious emotional distress. That's just one potential nefarious use of AI that the California legislature and Gavin Newsom decided to ban this year.
And then I also wanted to ask you about housing. This is a perpetual issue, it seems, in California, where our high housing prices and our housing crisis has really led to all sorts of calamitous challenges, from homelessness to outward migration of the middle class to just squeezing people right and left. And it seems like it's really on the legislature to try to address this. Any highlights on housing that you want to talk about that the legislature passed last year?
Sure. Yeah, there have been the legislature has really been focused on housing as an issue for a number of years now. And so, in recent years, California has really seen housing production overall has been relatively flat. We haven't seen like the kind of massive increase in home building that the governor and lawmakers have been calling for. But one area where there really has been a big increase in housing production has been on accessory dwelling units. Sometimes they're called granny flats, but basically like little units that people build on existing lots, like a little sort of guest house type thing on an existing housing lot. And there was a law passed this last year that takes effect this year that makes it even easier to get some of those ADU accessory dwelling units approved. It makes it a little easier to build those. There's also another new law that gives the Attorney General power to essentially fine local governments that violate certain housing laws, and those can include fees of up to $50,000 per month. So this is part of a trend that we've been seeing in the legislature over the last few years of sort of streamlining regulations to make it easier to build, at least in theory, and then also stiffening penalties for cities that don't do what the state government determines is their fair share of approving and planning for housing.
Yeah, I think maybe more on tap on housing this coming legislative session as well. So we can check back in a year on what happens. Of course, we'll cover some of these topics during this year as well. Housing is always a perpetual interest. Want to ask you just in the couple of minutes we have left here about an issue related to the culture wars with a law about notifying parents when students use different pronouns. Can you talk about that law and what that could mean for educators and students and their families?
Yeah, so in recent years, there have been a number of school districts in California that have passed policies essentially requiring teachers to notify parents if students start asking to use different pronouns or a different name or in some way identifying as transgender. California lawmakers and the governor decided that was not something that they thought that school districts should be doing, so they essentially passed a ban on those policies. It doesn't prohibit teachers from talking with students' parents about students, but it prohibits school districts from requiring teachers to essentially out trans children to their parents.
And also, this may not affect a lot of listeners, but what about this law that is now banning legacy admissions for colleges, for higher education?
Yeah, so this law essentially does exactly what it sounds like. It bans schools from giving preference to what are known as legacy applicants, people who maybe their parents went to that school or they have other relatives who went there. It also bars special preference for children of donors. And really just aims to even the playing field when it comes to college admissions.
All right. Well, we're out of time, but I just want to thank you for joining us, Sophia Bolag of the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks for covering all of these new laws that are in place here in California.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, we're going to meet Berkeley's new mayor, Adina Ishii. She will answer our questions and yours. That's right after the break. So stay with us. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. This past November, Adina Ishii was elected as Berkeley's new mayor, replacing Jesse Eregin, who won his own election to the California State Senate. Now, Ishii was sworn into office on December 6th and is making history as the first Asian American and woman of color to be Berkeley's mayor. A former president of the Berkeley chapter of the League of Women Voters, Ishii has never held elective office before, but has degrees from UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, as well as Santa Clara University School of Law. So welcome to the program, and congratulations, Mayor Ishii.
Thank you so much, and thanks so much for having me, Ethan.
And before we begin, I want to find out from you, our listeners, what are your questions for Mayor Ishii? This is your chance to ask her. You can send them to us now via email to stateofthebay@kalw.org. You can also find us on social media or call us. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And you can ask Mayor Ishii questions yourself. So let's kick it off, Mayor Ishii. Just, you're now about a month into this job. What has the first month been like for you?
You know, it's so funny. They swear me in. I get a chance to come in and get set up on my email. I had my first city council meeting, and then the council actually just goes on break. So technically, we're still on break, and it was my first day in the actual office today. So it's been very exciting to, you know, get going on some of those early meetings. But it's kind of a hurry up and wait situation a little bit at the moment.
Well, I'm glad someone's holding down the fort at City Hall. It's good to know that you're there even if they're on break. So let's talk a little bit about your background and how you ended up in Berkeley. How did you get into politics? How did this all come together for you?
Yeah, so I came to Berkeley as a student. So I was at Berkeley City College, which I can literally see from my office window right now, which is amazing. And I came during a time of really rough budget cuts to education. And that was very frustrating for me as someone who strongly believes in public education and oftentimes faced barriers myself in accessing higher education. And so I started to help organize my peers on rallies against these budget cuts up to Sacramento, and just started by organizing people. I got very involved with the League of Women Voters, and as you mentioned, was our president here of the local Berkeley Albany Emeryville League. And I really just caught the bug. You know, it was a really great way to be connected to the community and serve the people here in our city.
And I know you come from a background that has been challenging at times, but you've navigated a lot of public services and institutions to improve your situation and become very educated on these issues and just in general. What have you learned in the course of all that about the role of government in people's lives?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you said the role of government in people's lives. And I will say another part of my background that I think is important to talk about is that I'm Japanese American and my family was incarcerated during World War II. So when you talk about the impact on people's lives, I really understand that the government can have a very significant impact on people's lives, not only just on issues that I really care about, you know, my priority issues, housing and homelessness, public safety and infrastructure, but the great power to make some pretty serious damage. So, you know, I think I'm, like you said, I'm lucky, you know, I'm someone who's experienced housing insecurity. Unfortunately, I'm a survivor of different crimes. And that did teach me a lot about the systems and how we can advocate for change and make sure that we're reaching the people who need the most support from our government.
And what kind of changes do you want to see? When you look at Berkeley, what do you see as really the top challenges that you want to dig into and try to address?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, you know, my top issues are housing and homelessness, public safety and infrastructure. You know, I think that, you know, I was really seen and I am, you know, was a very pro housing candidate. And as mayor, you know, I intend to continue to be pro housing. We look at the issue of homelessness and so many people don't have access to housing. I think that homelessness is actually going to be a very significant issue throughout my tenure. And I think it's important that we're talking about it as an issue and that we're clear that we're not saying that the people are the issue. That's really important to me.
Well, and I would love to get into each of those issues in turn. I'm just curious before I ask you about those, just in general, how you would see your administration being different from that of the outgoing mayor, Ergin, who we mentioned is now in the state Senate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for me, you know, I have to say Mayor Ergin and now, you know, Senator Ergin was so up on policy. And I would say, I imagine he would identify as being sort of a policy wonk. And I'll be honest, I'm not a policy wonk. You know, I'm someone who obviously in my work with the League of Women Voters and my work in local politics for over a decade here and You know, obviously I understand and really appreciate and study policy, but I'm someone who really thinks it's important to connect with people. And I would say that that will be kind of a, maybe a bit of a difference in that we want to make sure that the mayor's office is really accessible to the people of Berkeley. I'm really excited to host open houses here once we kind of get this office, you know, more set up and really making sure that I'm out in the community talking to people.
Well, and as you mentioned, you are or ran as a pro-housing candidate. And of course, the outgoing mayor, Ed Gein, was also pro-housing, even recently recognized as Changemaker of the Year by the National Pro-Housing Nonprofit Enterprise Community Partners. I'm curious where you would see a divergence here now. How is your leadership on housing going to be different from the previous mayor?
You know, I can't say necessarily how we would be different. I would say that we both are pro-housing. I will say that something that I am really focused on, and I know that the mayor, previous mayor, cared about this as well, is the impact when we talk about the impact on, you know, people of color, especially, and the history of racism in our housing systems. I do think that that is something that's important to highlight. I would say maybe not a point of differentiation, but just something that I'm thinking about.
And where specifically do you feel like progress can be made in Berkeley in terms of housing? I mean, there is construction happening there. I work during the daytime at UC Berkeley Law School, and I see a lot of construction on Shattuck in particular. But just curious where you see the housing production coming in Berkeley.
Yeah, I mean, there are already so many projects in the pipeline. You know, the university is, as I'm sure you know, is going to be building a lot more housing for their students. I think it's a travesty that there are so many students who are experiencing housing insecurity. As someone who was one of those students, that's really important to me that the university continues to build housing. But, you know, also there are so many other projects, especially looking at how we can support affordable housing projects throughout our city. That's something that matters a lot to me as well, because, of course, we know just the cost of housing is so high in our city.
So what are some
and around the Bay Area.
Absolutely. It's a statewide problem, if not a national problem at this point, at least in our cities. So what specifically would you plan to do or would like to do to address housing affordability?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that we need to be building, you know, housing just generally. I think that that is really important, you know, across different income levels. And we also know that the type of housing that we are really in need of is affordable housing. And that really needs to be subsidized. I know that we had a regional bond measure that was supposed to be on this last November ballot that had to get pulled for legal reasons. And that really is something that we had hoped would move forward so that we could have more funding to support affordable housing. And I think with this current, you know, presidential administration, there will be some challenges potentially in accessing funding to build more affordable housing. So that is something that we're really trying to make sure we do is identify more funding to support those projects.
And local governments, cities and counties in California are under obligations to provide and build, see built a certain amount of housing. San Francisco famously has to build 82,000 new housing units. Is Berkeley on track to meet its state mandated housing requirements?
Yes, I would say that, you know, we've worked really hard to make sure that we're on track. I think that it's tough because there have been so many barriers to building housing, building really anything in our city for a while, and change is difficult for people. And that's something that I really want to highlight. I think that change can be scary, change can be hard, and we want to make sure that people also don't feel left behind as we're moving forward and building housing, because we want to welcome our neighbors and we want to be a welcoming city that's affordable. Something that I really notice is how there don't seem to be as many children and families in our city. And I think that that's really because of the affordability factor.
And you referenced homelessness a minute or two ago. It's obviously a regional issue, a statewide issue. How specifically are you planning to address it in Berkeley? What kinds of approaches are you considering?
Yeah, I think when it comes to homelessness, one of the things that we really need to make sure we're talking about is mental health. We have city services, of course, that provide support. But to me, there need to be more places for folks to go. That means more shelters and shelters that are set up for specific populations. That means more mental health support. That means just generally more outreach and relationship building, because I think that there is a huge lack of trust between the unhoused community, unfortunately, and the city at the moment. And one of the things that I really want to be able to do is to rebuild those relationships, because I think that this issue oftentimes gets framed in this sort of like, you either care about folks that are unhoused or you don't care. You just don't want to see them on the street, period. You just don't want to see them. And I don't think that that's right. I actually think there are so many things that we can get behind, like those solutions that I was talking about, where we can all get behind them, and doesn't matter why. Point is, we want to solve this issue. And that's really important to me, is like coming together around these solutions that we can just move forward.
So this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing the future of Berkeley with the new mayor, Adina Ishii. And what do you think that Mayor Ishii should be prioritizing? We'd love to hear from you. You can call us with your questions or comments now at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, 8255. Or you can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And we do have an email comment in from Barb, who writes, "I am a disabled person who can't bike. Please don't turn Berkeley into too much of a bike-only city. I still need a car to get places." So Mayor Ishii, what would you say to Barb in terms of your plans, just for mobility in general, but particularly for safe biking lanes?
Yeah, Barb, thank you so much for commenting. I think that that's a really important issue. You know, infrastructure is one of my top priorities. And, you know, I am someone who really believes in complete streets. And that really means for everyone, not just bikers, not just cars. I think that we need to be looking at how our different systems are working for everyone. And I definitely am having conversations with disability rights advocates throughout my campaign as well, where we were having conversations about how Berkeley was at the forefront of the disability rights movement, and how many activists feel that we are not only no longer leading the movement, but that we're really just not doing enough. And so I am interested in taking a look and seeing, you know, how can we be better in this area? How can we make sure that Berkeley is a friendly city for everyone, especially as we look at how we have a larger aging population, not necessarily larger than other cities, but we just have an aging population, and we need to make sure that it's accessible. Our streets are accessible for everyone.
And we have another email question on this topic of protected bicycle lanes that I want to share from Joel, who writes, "The two-way protected cycle tracks proposed for the Hopkins corridor are inherently dangerous on streets that require drivers to cross multiple directions of vehicle and bicycle traffic. And in addition, 200 parking spaces along Hopkins would be eliminated for all sorts of people in the community. The council member, I think, in that area has made it clear she will not listen to concerns of her constituents who oppose the plan. Is there anything that would lead you to not support the plan?" I know that's a pretty hyper-local question. Maybe, Mayor Ishii, if you want to just first describe what the project that our listener Joel is referencing and your position on it.
Sure, yeah. And so the Hopkins Street changes is something that was very and is very controversial in our communities still to this day. Like I said, I think that there are some issues in our city that become very like black and white. And I think it's really important that we're looking at these issues from, you know, very holistic perspective. So to maybe make it more bay-wide, it is really complicated to look at how we can make streets safe, but we can also make sure that we are, you know, providing opportunities for people to bike, and people who are disabled to, you know, find parking and be able to access stores. It's a very challenging balance. This is an issue that we're going to have to take a look at here in our city. I'm sure that it will come up again soon. I think that there's been a little bit of waiting because folks wanted to see, you know, who the mayor will be. But I am someone, you know, having my background in nonpartisan politics with the League of Women Voters, that really believes it's important to look at all sides of an issue before determining how to move forward.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned for how that one unfolds. Let's talk about public safety now. You state that you want to give police and firefighters, quote, the tools they need to keep us safe. Can you give us examples of what some of these tools might be, and where will the money for them come from?
Yeah, so let me also say that when I talk about public safety, I usually start by talking about social services, mental health, and also youth programming. I think that that's really important to say. Of course, it is important that our police and fire departments have the tools they need to keep us safe. One thing I think about in particular is infrastructure with our fire departments. I was lucky enough to get a chance to do a ride along, a 10-hour ride along with one of the stations here in South Berkeley, and learn about, you know, the insufficiencies of their buildings and, you know, not having the correct or enough like apparatus, which is their trucks and things like that. You know, we are a city that's always really concerned about fire danger, especially up in the hills where we have a lot of beautiful greenery. And we want to make sure our fire departments have the tools that they need. And, you know, when it comes to the police department, you know, one of the things that's been also a hot button issue here is around like license plate readers and cameras. And I've been someone who's been in support of that. I think that, you know, there are a lot of technologies that we can be utilizing to keep our community safe. And there are so many people who are feeling, I think, still very scared. You know, even just walking around the street in their own neighborhood, I'll tell you that I have a daughter, and even just going to and from school, she doesn't oftentimes feel safe and has preferred to ride in a car as opposed to take public transportation. And that's really not acceptable.
It definitely a basic issue for Berkeley and other levels of government to try to solve here. You mentioned infrastructure in your answer just now, and I know you ran on improving Berkeley's infrastructure, Prop EE, which raised money for street repair and other infrastructure, would have raised money, did not pass, but Prop FF did. Can you talk about your plans for infrastructure and in particular green infrastructure?
Yes. I think that that's so great. I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, infrastructure, I think that the kind of joke is that it's not a very sexy issue. And so people don't seem to care that much about it. And so, you know, one of the things that I really like to do is kind of show my passion for infrastructure and how that can be a climate issue, how that can be a safety issue, you know, how we can think about transportation and even like sewer and our housing, the way that we build things. There's so many connections here to infrastructure. And I'm really interested and excited to support projects that help to green our city, make it more beautiful. I'm really excited that, you know, we've been planting a lot more trees. There was a garden in South Berkeley on that South Berkeley Oakland border that was just named after Miss Richie Smith, who's a neighbor who's down there all the time. I really like to see us encouraging those types of projects and get people out there because Berkeley has so many parks. I mean, you're in Berkeley all the time, so you know we have lots of beautiful parks.
Absolutely. And it's one of the perks of working there for sure. Any other climate goals you want to mention? I'm thinking maybe specifically of the voter initiative that failed in Berkeley to try to phase out natural gas as some of the larger businesses and buildings in the city. Any thoughts about what could be done to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and other climate goals?
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons that that measure came up in the first place was to make sure that there was funding so that people who wanted to switch over to, you know, electric heaters or heat pumps and things like that, that there would be funding to help support them in doing that. And so, you know, I am interested in finding a way forward to support folks in making those changes. I think that that's important. I know a lot of work that's already getting done to you know, increase our support of electric vehicles. I think that's important. And especially thinking about how we're helping folks who are low income to access those resources as well. Because when we talk about electric vehicles, many times we're talking about homeowners. And, you know, we need to also be thinking about, you know, how are we giving folks who live in apartment buildings access to those types of supports and infrastructure as well.
All right, we have another question, an email from a listener, Ruth, who writes in, is the mayor worried about negative attention from the new Trump administration? And if so, how can she handle this? So yeah, what are your thoughts now dealing with a incoming executive branch that presumably is going to be pretty hostile to cities like Berkeley in California here?
You know, I think it's so unfortunate that, you know, we may have a president who feels the need to pick on a city as small as we are. And I will say that one of the things I'm really proud of here is that we are a sanctuary city. And in our our city is actually going to be reestablishing our sanctuary city status, an item that Councilmember Blackaby has put forward that I'm co-sponsoring as well. And, you know, I think what's really important to me is that we focus on maintaining the values here of the city and also making sure that we continue just focusing on what the people need here locally. I really don't want our city to get caught up in a lot of national issues. I am very focused on making sure that our city runs smoothly, that we rebuild the trust between our government and the people, that we are focusing on the issues that I've mentioned before, housing, homelessness, public safety, and infrastructure. I literally have a countdown clock on my desk right now that tells me how many days I have left in office. And to me, that really reminds me every day that we need to focus on the local issues as much as possible, because there are plenty of other people who will get out there and, you know, and be antagonistic, I would say. There's a difference to me between protecting our values here and our people in our city, which I see as my job, and going looking for a fight, I would say.
We're speaking with Berkeley's new mayor, Adina Ishii. This is Ethan Elkind, your host here for State of the Bay on KALW San Francisco Bay Area. If you have questions for Mayor Ishii, we'd love to hear from you. You can email them to stateofthebay@kalw.org, or you can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We have just a few minutes left, but we'd still love to hear from any listeners who do want to call in. Mayor Ishii, I know you're going to have to work with the Berkeley City Council. And as you mentioned, they're on break right now, but 5 of the 9 council members are new this term, and you not holding elected office previously. How do you think this relative lack of experience in city government is going to play out? Who are you going to be relying on for help and institutional knowledge? And same for the city council members who are going to be new.
Yeah, well, I have to say, I have a really great team. We have someone who was in former Mayor Aragin's office. I have someone who's an advisor to my office who was also in former Mayor Tom Bates's office. So in terms of having the history and some continuity, that's something I really thought about a lot in creating my team. And I'm so lucky that we have an amazing city manager, Paul Bunagan. He's really fantastic, and he's been an excellent partner in helping us, you know, get settled into our office. I think that something I think about here is that it's really important that we're building the relationships between council members. I think that this is a group of very smart, capable people who are going to do just fine. And of course, like in our early days, just like in any job, you know, things aren't going to be perfect, but what's really important is how we recover, how we move forward, and that we do it together.
And I want to talk, maybe zoom out and more generally, about Berkeley. It's really held up as a sort of a model, and in some case, maybe a stereotype of what it means to be progressive. And you yourself have said that you want Berkeley to be a progressive beacon. And this is now at a time where progressivism was handed a pretty harsh defeat at the national level and is really on the defensive now. So I'm wondering just how you would respond to criticism of progressivism, and maybe what role you think Berkeley can play in sort of defining a version of it for the country going forward.
I invite anyone who thinks that, you know, Berkeley is not a wonderful place to be to come and see, you know, what a progressive city can look like. You know, I'm so proud of living in this amazing place. I spent a couple of weeks on the East Coast, and it was cold and it was dry. And I came back here, and I'll tell you, I was just so grateful to be back here. There are so many amazing things about this city. I think that, you know, when we talk about this backlash against progressivism, I mean, like, it's a pendulum, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I see it. And, you know, I think that I'm really proud of the way our city is. There's always room for progress, and there's always room to improve on things. And that's what we'll continue to do. But I am really proud of the city, and I love living here, so.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way as the new mayor of Berkeley. Well, I want to move on now to some questions that we ask of all public officials who come on our show, although we've tweaked them for your circumstance here. So first, what is a favorite place of yours in Berkeley?
Oh gosh, I really love Cesar Chavez Park down at the Berkeley Marina. I also really love going out on the hills and just looking at the beautiful view. I would say that those are kind of two of my favorites, being near the water or seeing the whole view.
Absolutely. We're blessed in the East Bay to have that view across towards the Golden Gate Bridge. So, what do you do for fun?
Oh my gosh, so many things. I have three dogs, so spend a lot of time with them, take walks. There's so much good food to eat here. There's so much fun to things to do, theater, and I love cooking and baking. I love being with people. Honestly, that was my favorite thing about the whole campaign, is just meeting so many people and hearing their stories.
Well, I'm sure you got a chance to really get a large meet a large cross section of the city and the voters. All right, last question. What is a book, TV show, or movie that you've enjoyed recently?
I feel like watching Parks and Rec, I feel like, is very appropriate. I don't know if you've ever seen that show, but if you haven't, I mean, local government and kind of to the nth degree, right?
All right, so maybe that's good prep then for your job. And I want to congratulate you again for the electoral victory and wish you luck in your term as mayor. That's incoming Berkeley Mayor Adina Ishii. Thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
You too. And coming up after the break, we're going to hear producer Chris Nooney's interview with San Francisco's new poet laureate, Jenny Lim. We'll be right back.
On Your Call, we talk about current events, politics, arts, and the media. We're always thinking about ways people can get involved and make change. And we want your knowledge and experience in the mix. I'm Rose Aguilar. Join the conversation on Your Call weekdays at 10 a.m. on KALW, or make your voice heard anytime. Email us, yourcall@kalw.org, or tweet at yourcallradio.
KALW is listener-funded, so we're reliant on you to support the programming we all deserve. There are many ways to help, whether it's donating money or stocks or used cars. And if you want to ensure generations of listeners can continue to learn from and enjoy KALW, please consider including us and the audiences we serve in a bequest. Make it happen by contacting our Advancement Director, John Carroll. He's at john, that's J-O-N, at kalw.org. You make our work possible. Thank you.
A boy ran up the hill with his 1 o'clock kite. He glided his ballerina over rooftops, across the bluest sky. Blood froze on his ruby lips by 6 o'clock. And the ballerina leapt from his hand. Without purpose, time presses the hour of day like a finger on the pulse of memory.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Chris Nooney. That moving poem you just heard was written and performed by our next guest, Jenny Lim. Jenny is the author of five poetry collections and co-editor of a collection of poems found written on Angel Island's barrack walls by Chinese detainees. In August, she was named San Francisco's ninth poet laureate. I'm so pleased to be joined by Jenny now. Jenny Lim, welcome to State of the Bay, and congratulations on being named poet laureate of San Francisco.
Thank you, Chris. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we're really thrilled to have you. And I wanted to start with that piece we played leading into this segment, which was such a powerful way to present your poetry. Can you tell us a little bit about what we heard?
You know, since the Middle East has exploded, we have Syria being bombed, started with Palestine, and we have Ukraine going. And I'm always thinking about the children who always just want to play and live in their magical fantasy worlds. And I had this vision of a little boy running through the town, watching his kite flying. And then at some moment in the day, he's gone. And it's a, could be a missile, could be shots fired from an automatic rifle. And you see this image of the kite floating, suspended in the air, and the little boy is gone. And I see all these children now in Palestine, their childhood lost. It's just unfathomable. And this was 10 years ago I wrote that poem. So this is how long the Middle East has been in turmoil. You know, nowhere is safe.
Mm-hmm. Do you like to use your poetry to address what's going on in the world?
You know, I don't do it intentionally. I think my mind is always brewing on a lot of the problems of the world. And I would like to just write about love and butterflies and birds, which I do as well. But these dark times, I'm just compelled to think about the things that we're dealing with, from climate change to anti-Asian violence, all at once, everywhere, you know, and how we can keep a peaceful state of mind. I feel as a writer, an urgent responsibility not to just appease people, but to also make them conscious of their role as a human being. I think all of us have a mission in life to ease each other's suffering.
Yeah, absolutely. And poetry and other art is such a great vehicle for doing that. The other element of that piece that I want to mention is the music. You've done a number of collaborations with musical artists. I'd love to hear why you're drawn to pairing music with your poetry.
Chris, it started with my oral tradition on my mother's part. She was a village herbalist, and we grew up taking herbs for everything, and everything was sung. They were mnemonic chants. They called them wood and fish songs back in China, and this is what my mother grew up learning. It was the itinerant singers that oftentimes they were blind, and they would be paid nominal fees or just given food to sing at weddings and funerals. And all the village women would sing their blues, basically. And I always heard the connection between that sound and the rural Black Southern blues sounds. And from the blues, jazz, I naturally gravitated to music. I hear music as I'm writing. And so the lyricism and the melody and the intonation and the cadence and the rhythm, they all cohere. So it's very natural for me to work with musicians because I hear my poetry in the same way they hear sound.
Yeah, it's really just such a beautiful way to hear your poetry. And I love that there is that background from your mother's history. And speaking of your history, you are the first Chinese American named as San Francisco's Poet Laureate. And I mentioned in the introduction, you co-edited a collection of poetry written by Chinese detainees on Angel Island. So I'd love for you to tell us a little bit more about that project and maybe share how your cultural identity has shaped your poetry?
Wow, those are big questions. You know, actually, 1970 is when the poems were discovered on Angel Island by a park ranger. And I was volunteering at a local bilingual Chinese American newspaper. And there was an editor there by the name of Judy Young. And then there was a lay historian, Himark Lai. And we all three decided we wanted to look at the poems and publish them in the newspaper. Well, we went to the island, and the walls were covered with inscriptions written and also carved into the woodwork in the barracks where the inmates were detained. And we felt their spirit, and we felt the strong urgency to record the poems. So we translated them into Chinese, and we came up with not just the poetry translations, but the oral histories of the former detainees and some of the staff, the interpreters, administrators. It was a labor of love. And since the publication, the information about Angel Island has spawned a whole generation of artists from San Francisco Ballet to Del Sol String Quartet, who I collaborate with. And then we have plays that have been written about Angel Island and books. So I'm really glad that people have taken this history and explored it in depth.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. Can people go to Angel Island and see the inscriptions?
Oh, yes. And everyone who goes, they come back really struck emotionally and psychologically, and they really feel the desolation there.
I can imagine. I think that's a great thing for people to put on their list to do. Angel Island is so beautiful anyway. So that just is another wonderful Bay Area activity. And speaking of the Bay Area, you were born and raised here and have lived here most of your life. Can you talk about how that's shaped your poetry?
Growing up in North Beach, Chinatown, I had the best of many worlds. I had the North Beach poets experience, you know, would hang out at City Lights and pull books off the shelf. So I read Howl as a young kid and didn't understand a lot of the poems, but I love the musicality and the way language was so transportive for me. I would read them out loud and imagine the poetry live. And there were jazz clubs around. I had an older sibling who was into the jazz and Zen and poetry. So I had a lot of influences from that. Then I had a father who was very hip for an old Chinese gentleman. And he loved jazz. And he loved big bands, Ernie Hechter, Stan Kenton. And he was quite eloquent and gave a lot of speeches at the Lim Family Association. We both had a love for music and language. So I think all of that shaped my love of poetry. And in those days, I never imagined being a poet because that just wasn't anything in our community to aspire to. So I kind of had a secret life. There was a place called The Offering in South Venice, and I went to see West Side Story, and I was so thrilled and charmed and amazed that I auditioned and got in for a play called Milk and Honey. Ironically, I played an Arab boy, and I sang my little song, "Why Can't I Walk My Sheep in the Streets? The streets are supposed to be free." So I think everything kind of links up. Doing theater and now doing poetry and having music, I'm truly blessed to be able to bring all of my loves together.
Yes, a very enriching artistic background. What is your vision for your role as poet laureate?
Given all of the different spheres that I operate from, jazz, and then I've done collaborations in the Black community, and I'm really attached to the Mission community, as well as the Chinatown community. So my vision is diversity, and to hear the voices of different communities and to spotlight these different communities, especially the youth. We're going to debut a youth poet laureate for San Francisco. The youth are just exploding with their voices. So would like to work with the San Francisco Public Library branches and do collaborative events there with music and poetry.
That sounds like fun. It's such a wonderful organization, the library.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for. Jenny Lim is San Francisco's new poet laureate. Thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
It's my honor and privilege. Thank you, Chris.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen so you never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, you can visit our page on klw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, you can email us anytime at stateofthebay@klw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Chris Nooney, who you just heard doing that interview. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. Your Call is coming up next as a rebroadcast. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.